Good evening, good morning. Thank you for tuning into the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening. My name is Dave Schrader. We're getting close to Halloween, right around the corner here, less than a week away. It's a good time to examine ghost stories and claims of the supernatural. Tonight, we've got a doozy of a show lined up for you. Back-to-back guests coming in the first 2 hours of tonight's show, the world's most haunted house. The true story of the Bridgeport poltergeist on Lindley Street. That's with guest William Hall in the first 2 hours. Then, in the last 2 hours of tonight's show, Roger Clark joins us to talk about his new book, Ghosts, A Natural History, 500 Years of Searching for Proof. If you're a fan of the strange and the supernatural, the paranormal, tonight is the night you want to stay with us for the whole show. We'll be opening up phone lines for both guests. So if you have questions and stories you'd like to relate and share with us, you can certainly do that. We're going to take a break so we can get right back into it with our guests. Stay tuned to the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. William J. Hall is our guest for the first 2 hours this evening. He was born and raised in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Bill is a magician experienced in researching the unexplained, from folklore and urban legend to fortune telling, the pyramids, and other mysterious tales. His syndicated 1990s column, Magic and the Unknown, ran for 6 years in multiple local newspapers in his home state. His book is out and available. It's called The World's Most Haunted House, The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street. Let's welcome to Coast to Coast AM this evening, William Hall. Good evening, William.
Good evening.
It's great to talk with you again. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dave.
This is a pretty big claim, William. I mean, to come out with a book and the title being The World's Most Haunted House, I mean, there's certainly been a lot of stories that have laid claim to that. How did this story come to your attention at first?
Well, to clarify the title, first of all, World's Most Haunted House, the publisher really liked that because it seemed to embody the fact that this became so public. These stories normally don't get, I mean, some of them get public, of course, but this got the attention of, went around the world. So because of that, that's why it was named that way. As far as how I got involved in it, I was just having coffee, reading Facebook, and somebody in one of the community pages said, does anybody remember the haunted house on Lindley Street? And it occurred to me, I never really looked into that. And I just started looking into the newspaper articles online, and there were just way too many witnesses for this to be something that at least definitely would require further investigation. There's police officers, firefighters, reporters, priests, neighbors, onlookers, just very intriguing, but of course left more questions than answered. So I wrote everybody's names down, started making calls, and that's kind of how it all began.
Now, you grew up in the town where this story took place, correct?
Yes.
And do you remember this when the story broke? Did it ping your radar at an early age?
Yes, I was 10 years old at the time. And of course, being 10 years old and, you know, remembering back now, I couldn't tell you what I saw on TV. But I remember sitting in the living room and seeing it was on TV all the time for at least the, you know, during the height of it, the few days there. And I remember being very intrigued by it and, you know, of course, Dad controlled the TV in those days. Not like today, we had TVs in every room. Now I'm sounding old, but, you know, the only reason I watch it is because Dad was watching the news, you know. So I do remember it being on there and was very intrigued by it. But
Well, Bill, when you've got these stories on the news, your parents are watching it. I mean, how was your household with this kind of topic? Did you ask about ghosts? Were they open and willing to discuss this, or was it something that was just kind of flight of fancy and they really didn't pay too much attention to it?
Well, my dad is, you know, the ultimate skeptic. So I immediately asked him, you know, is this true, Dad? And, you know, he said, oh, no, of course not. You know? and that was kind of it. Which is funny because today he's actually reading the book. I'm proud of him. He's has that little bit of openness to it because he's heard me talk about it so much, and he feels that perhaps there's more to it than he originally thought. So that's an interesting turnaround because he's the ultimate skeptic. You know, don't bother me with the data. My mind's made up. I don't want to hear the facts. Anything.
What's the score of the game? That's all that really matters at this point, right?
Right.
Now, this book, I mean, you go pretty detailed in this and digging up the information. I mean, going back at a story that's, almost, 40 years old.
Yeah.
Was it easy to find witnesses that were still wanting to talk about this story, or was it really hard piecing this puzzle together again?
Thanks to social media, the amount of witnesses and help from the community, if you will, was amazing. Children of now deceased witnesses, friends, people in the family, people who worked with the husband, Jerry Gooden, in the story. Just people were coming from all over saying, hey, you should talk to this person. This person was there. My dad was a police officer and knew this person. You should talk to this person. Now, granted, a lot of the people are no longer with us, but luckily, because of the investigation, their interviews were preserved on tape and kind of lay dormant for the 40 years. But I did do another 10, 15 hours of interviews on my own, and there were just a lot of new witnesses. There's still witnesses coming forward. The thing just never ends. It involved and touched so many people. But
as a magician, Bill, you know how easy it is to fool people. People can be, transfixed and sleight of hand. You distract them doing one thing, and then, boom, you're able to pass the illusion on. As somebody who is researching this with the background you have in understanding magic, illusion, and the way people's minds work, how did you separate fact from fiction? I would guess that'd be, more importantly, how do you get past your own skepticism of the story and accept what people believe to be fact?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I remember it was probably around hour 20 of the interviews, not because any of the interviews pointed towards it being a hoax or a mental illness or a little girl or anything like that, but just because I had to hear from a cross-section of witnesses, so, I had to have the right quantity of witnesses, and I wanted to hear all of the police officers, including an officer who thought it was a hoax, although he wasn't there in the house when the activity occurred, finding that out after listening to it. But so it really took a lot of hours of listening to the interviews and hearing the family. And it really is, that totality of the evidence was really there. And then there were some things that just really, to make a refrigerator float, sure, you can have a fake refrigerator, you can have hydraulics, but all logic says, hydraulics and a hookup to the refrigerator was not involved. So when it gets to that point, a magician can make a picture fly off the wall and things like that, but we're talking about, cold spots, entities appearing in various forms, a multitude of witnesses, a chair rising up and flipping while police are talking to the little girl. I mean, when you look at the real detail involved here, it's without question real. But, I had to get to that detail because just reading the newspapers, of course, all we're hearing are the results, the perceptions of what people saw. And I wanted to really get down to, what exactly did they view versus, how they explain what they saw.
And see, that's what intrigues me, getting through that and trying to, put yourself in the perspective of remaining objective and collecting the story, being skeptical and knowing that the mind can easily be tricked and that people can make mistakes, that, you know, something very mundane and natural people like to accept as the paranormal. Houses settling, yeah. Creaks in the wood, things like this. Now, you went into this investigation skeptical of the claims that were being made, correct?
Yeah, I basically start every investigation that way. You know, I start with assuming the natural until, you know, I get to the point where it's, clear that it is something that would be paranormal. Unless, of course, you know the person. If you know the person who's involved in the investigation or that kind of thing, obviously you can get from point A to B quicker. But in a case where, like this, where, you know, you're looking back at something, you really need the detail in order to do that. I was quite lucky because Boyce Beatty, the lead investigator, asked questions with such detail that, because I could have gotten interviews that went like this, you know, what happened? Oh, I saw the refrigerator flow. Oh, that's interesting. What else did you see? You know, and then I really wouldn't have known what they actually saw. I would only kind of know it would be okay, but if, you know, I would know what they interpret as seeing versus the way he asked it. When they describe what they saw, a voice would say, well, wait a minute, let's back up. What is the very first thing you see? Did you see all four legs come up? Did it wobble? Did it make a noise? I mean, he went into such great detail, and I was so relieved that I couldn't have done it better myself, you know, that it was interviewed to the level where you really understood what they saw, not just what they say they saw or what they perceived, but the step-by-step of what they actually viewed.
And that's fascinating that they would have thought at that time, instead of just blowing it off as, you know, somebody actually having a breakdown or hallucinating these thoughts, he went into it very detailed to ask these questions to try to get an understanding. And I'm curious, giving us kind of a background, a little bit of your take, had you ever experienced anything you would consider paranormal in your own life prior to researching this information for the book?
Yes, but at a point where I really couldn't conclude what it was. I mean, I remember being me and a magician buddy, we would go hang out in the graveyard. Yeah, that explains why I didn't get many dates. And, you know, we would talk there and, you know, shoot the breeze and try to create some tricks or discuss things. And one time we had... we put the radio on static and just kind of let it sit in static. We were going to do a little experiment. It must have been that way for about 20 minutes, and we were going to say somebody's name on the gravestone over and over. You know, that was our little experiment. Because even being magicians, we weren't completely closed-minded. We,
sure.
You know, we wanted to do it. So we picked somebody that had, you know, they had the pictures on the gravestones. That was always, I found that always to be a little... well, at least years ago, a little creepy, but and so we did that, and we said this lady's name. I remember it was Mary, and we would say it over and over, and just static. You know, if you're there, you know, communicate with us through the radio, that kind of thing. And then we agreed, hey, you know, let's just really forcefully, you know, Mary, you know, and we did it, and the static stopped. And we heard, you know, like almost like it went into station, then went back to static. And it, you know, it scared the yelp out of us. It actually would have been a perfect prank for one of us to play on the other, but it wasn't the case. So, you know, you look at that and you say, well, you know, was that something or not? I mean, it could have been nothing, but it was just weird because it sat on static for like 20 minutes. And it wasn't until the very second that we ended that it kind of interrupted. So those were kind of my experiences. They were kind of the, you know, not really sure. Nothing, of course, of anywhere near the magnitude of, you know, Lindley Street, of course, where it's, you know, you don't have to wonder. It was very obvious, so.
Well, I know, and the reason I ask that is, I know magicians, and I'm good friends with quite a few illusionists and magicians, and they're the hardest people in the world to talk to about the paranormal because they just don't buy into it. Unless they had their own experience in their life. Do you think that's what kind of kept you open to the idea when you started to research this? You know, you had somewhat of a strange antidote of your own to build off of?
There was some things to build off of, mainly in the UFO area. I had ordered government documents and did things like that. As far, I always tried to go one further. If there was a way that I could get closer to the story and see for myself, I never liked to take the position of what a lot of my friends did, which would say, oh, well, that's fake. You know, I would say, all right, well, maybe, but why don't we, I'm going to order it. You know, I'm going to order it from the government and see what right. they'll send it to me. And then we don't have to wonder if it, aren't you curious? You know, that's what I couldn't understand. How could you not be curious? You know, it's easy enough to get to the bottom of this. And so I did it. And I'd get the government document and then I'd compare it to what the book said. And now I could see for real, does this make sense? And, you know, what are my own conclusions? So based on some of those other interesting things that, you know, during writing the newspaper columns that I came across that maybe made you kind of go, oh, well, that's really interesting. You know, and some of them were, you know, folklore things you couldn't necessarily prove, but they were beyond just the regular, you know, that's just a story, whatever. They were things that had some merit to it. And so I remained open-minded because of that. And also Houdini was very open-minded. He never found anything, although with the way he went about it, you know, going after psychics and mediums and that kind of thing, naturally he would attract all of the popular people of the day that were, you know, that were shysters, so to speak, you know. So, but I admire the fact that he really was searching legitimately to find it, unlike an Amazing Randy who, you know, I don't care what the facts are, you know, my mind's made up and, you know, completely closed-minded. So, but Houdini always had that hope of trying to find something out there.
Well, let's start to talk about the case now. When it broke, what was the perception? I mean, with the newscasters, were they doing it tongue-in-cheek? I mean, the way it's handled in the news nowadays, when there's some kind of story, they play the X-Files theme in the background, and there's always right. the wink and the nod from the media doing this case. Were they reporting it just very factually? Were they taking it kind of tongue-in-cheek? How do you remember how that was being handled in your area?
It actually was it was a mixture, but I would say they were pretty respectful. You know, the one part, I guess, that you would say was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but kind of naturally so, was the rumor about the cat talking. And so, you know, the media would come in and put the microphones to the cat, and, you know, hey, cat, I hear you can talk. Would you say something for, you know? So that was a little crazy, and the media, of course, you know, loved that. There was audio phenomena. The cat, of course, didn't specifically talk, but so that was part of it. But a lot of the media, I was quite impressed that because this had so many witnesses. I think the approach was a bit different because, you know, when you have all these police officers coming out of the house and taking notes, and you know, and being afraid, and firemen then follow. And so because of, I think, all the people involved, it probably was treated maybe a bit differently than it would have if it was just, you know, word got out, but it didn't have all these witnesses from these, you know, credible people. So I think that was a part of it. And the other part is when the reporters, when they were allowed in the house, they weren't always allowed because, you know, the family really wasn't into that, but they did, because it became public, they did kind of want people to know they weren't crazy. But when reporters went in thinking they were outside of the story, you know, as reporters are, you know, I'm objective, I'm outside the story, and I'm going to go, you know, see what it's about. But when they saw phenomena, then suddenly they became part of the story. So that happened in many times, too, where after just being in the house 10 minutes or so, they realized that this was a family that was suffering. And in fact, the two radio reporters that went in there ended up leaving. They had no interviews on their microphone. They never took their microphone out of the case. They didn't feel it was proper. They really felt the seriousness of the situation and the reality of it. And then, of course, later they they saw a bunch of phenomena themselves, and they left. And of course, they realized, oh, you know, they didn't even know if they wanted to run the story. So there was a lot of compassion from the press, and it's really a wonderful job everybody did that was involved in it.
William J. Hall is our guest this hour and next hour. The book is called The World's Most Haunted House. You could check out worldsmosthauntedhouse.com for more information about our guest and to order his book. Stay tuned. We've got more Coast to Coast AM right after this. The World's Most Haunted House, the true story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street. Our guest for this hour and next, William J. Hall, will open up phone lines next hour if you have questions and stories you'd like to relate to this. Do you remember this story? We'd like to hear from you as well. A little bit later on in the show, Roger Clark is going to join us, and we'll discuss his research in the book Ghosts in Natural History, 500 Years of Searching for Proof. If you've missed any part of tonight's show or any past show and you'd like to catch up, it's really simple. You can become a Coast Insider for literally 15 cents a day. You'll get access to over 5 years of past archives. You'll also get access to live chats with George Norrie and other hosts from Coast to Coast AM and some of the best guests in the world. It's all on the site. Go check out coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com and become an insider. You'll find out what millions around the United States and around the world are listening to. You'll be able to check out the podcasts, information, news, and so much more. Check it out. Become an insider right now. Do me a favor. Go join us live in our chat room at darknessradio.com. That's darknessradio.com as we stream the show off of our website this evening. We encourage you to join us as other like-minded people involved in the paranormal that like to share their stories and like to hear about this. So join us over there. And if you like the strange and unusual, you can join me 5 nights a week, Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight Central Time on Darkness Radio, where we explore monsters, myths, legends, true crime, conspiracy, aliens, psychic phenomena, and so much more. That's Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight. Then you can keep your dial right there, because as soon as we wrap up, George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues your journey into the strange and unusual with the best in overnight talk radio. We'll be back with our guest, William Hall, as we talk more about the world's most haunted house right after this. This evening, we're discussing the world's most haunted house for the first 2 hours of Coast to Coast AM. William Hall is our guest this evening. This is a case that involved over 2,000 onlookers. National media reported jumping furniture, floating refrigerators, attacking entities, and talking cats. How could this story not have been blown up more? We've got the Amityville Horror. We've got the haunting in Connecticut, the haunting in Georgia, the haunting of this, the conjuring of that. But this story seems to still be relatively unknown. That is, until now, William Hall is sharing the story and opening it up for us. Let's take us back to 1974, Bridgeport, Connecticut. How does this story begin?
Well, in the public eye, it begins November 1974, and that's when Jerry Gooden, Laura Gooden, the husband and wife, and Marcia Gooden, their adopted 10-year-old child, they go away to New York, and they come back, and Jerry finds that Marcy's TV is off the shelf and on the bed. A little puzzled, he puts it back and turns around, and it comes down again. So he disconnects the TV and, you know, goes out to the car, not thinking too much of it. Just, it's weird, and that's it. They weren't believers in supernatural or anything like that. And he goes out to the car, bringing the groceries in, and Laura's in the kitchen with the groceries and, you know, starting to cook dinner, and the table lifts up and flips, and groceries go all over, and a giant standalone TV comes down on her toe, and dishes start flying around, and sofas are opening and closing on their own. Those standalone heavy 1970 recliners are opening and closing on their own. So, you know, things are going crazy. Finally, it settles down, and they end up staying up to like 3 a.m. in the morning, and but the next morning things continue, and they, you know, of course, then they had enough. So Jerry gets you know, his wife and child, and they run out on the porch, and they're jumping up and down calling for help. And I'd like to play an interview with their neighbor who comes to the rescue, who is lives directly across the street, or lived directly across the street from them, Officer John Holsworth of the Bridgeport Police Department. He was off duty at the time, and later that day, the media interviewed him, and he can describe how this really took off. Is that all right to play it now?
Certainly. Go ahead.
Yeah. All right. Here we go.
And you're with the Bridgeport Police Department. Can you tell me, did you respond to call? Because my brother was walking the dog, and she ran into the house and said, Joey Moore, which we know him by, was having an emergency, and I come right over. Oh, I think that I come over, and I saw a probe on the porch of Circle. And what did you find when you came into the house? Yeah, I came in and I found everything in array. I mean, just disarray. The table's over, the chair's over, the icebox moved, the toilet removed, and I was the only one in the house, and I was still on the porch. Did you actually fall down?
Good grief. Well, it seems that we're having a bit of a technical difficulty with that. Very strange timing as he's playing us some actual audio from this poltergeist case. Our guest this evening is William Hall. He's written the book, The World's Most Haunted House, The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street. An entire family terrorized by strange activity taking place in their home, from furniture jumping around to animals being affected by this, the poltergeist activity. And as we know, this poltergeist doesn't necessarily mean a ghost. It seems to be some kind of strange PK, psychokinetic type of activity that unleashes in some locations. Strange, erratic things happen where you will see, chairs stacking themselves, drawers and cabinets opening and shutting, appliances falling, and just strange activity that doesn't seem to make any sense. Now, this is one of the rare cases because in this story, aside from all of the physical activity that was taking place, there is also the situation that they were seeing entities. There were things that were going on and contact being made with these entities. And William, I'm glad that we've got you back on the line. I don't know what happened. The audio freaked out and we lost you on the call. But basically, this police officer is telling his tale of what happened as this family calls out. Now, you'd said that this all kind of happened in one night and it sent them out screaming and looking for help. Had anything been building up to that point?
Yes. Actually, Marcy was adopted in 1968. And shortly after she was adopted, from Canada, and she was a Five Nations Indian. And after she was adopted, things were happening, but it was very much like a simmer, very mild things. Like I saw a door move a little. Well, I call that mild. I mean, to me, that's a lot in itself. But,
right.
Keys being misplaced. I thought I pushed the chair in, those kinds of things. Nothing of this extreme nature of activity that ended up exploding in November 74. And in a typical poltergeist fashion, Marcy was really kind of the center of it, regardless of which theory you prescribe to. She definitely was at the center of it.
Right. And they refer to that as a poltergeist agent, somebody that almost works as the battery that feeds off of this strange haunting. Is it her psychokinetic energy? And most times it's a prepubescent teenage girl. How old was she in 1974 when this really took off?
She was 10 years old, but about to turn 11 in December. So she was right around that age. So we definitely know, like I said, regardless of, there's a bunch of theories, and one of them is the psychokinetic, and others just, because there were entities involved, I find the psychokinetic thing a little hard, but I guess it's all kind of hard to believe. You know,
well, the thing is, though,
theory, you know.
Right, with the theories and belief system, you know, people like Hans Holzer, D. Scott Rogo, even Dr. Barry Taff, a lot of the investigators have found that when you have this one poltergeist agent, sometimes if there is some spiritual activity, as they're feeding off the psychokinetic energy, the spirits may be drawn to that energy like a battery as well. So if that is true and you're feeding off this battery, that may be what's making the entities finally able to be seen and witnessed. Theoretically, again, that's kind of the belief system behind what happens when this poltergeist agent kind of reaches full force.
Hmm. Well, that would make sense, from that perspective. And the other thing, there was other houses affected, but I guess, whatever you believe the cause is, I think you're right. However these things get there, it appears whatever opens up or whatever brings them the full power also usually ends up impacting more than just the one house, and sometimes the other houses that are impacted, like in Lindley Street case, the other houses, there's three that we know of, and they, of course, didn't experience anywhere near the activity at Lindley Street, and the entities didn't even, appear the same. It was more like a shadow person kind of experience versus this more heightened entity,
sure.
Explosion at Lindley Street.
That would almost make you feel it's kind of like the magnet effect, right? When you take a paper clip and rub it against a magnet, the paper clip kind of becomes magnetized, so it has its own power. If the central battery is located nearby, other locations close, depending on how powerful this battery is, could be leeching off of it and making things seen, at least for that time. Do we know, was there any medical maladies that Marcy suffered? Was she epileptic, any mood issues, things like that might also help us understand a little bit about her condition?
No, I have, in my research, I did come across what appears to be the potential, for the epilepsy connection. But with Marcy, at least not that we know of, it would be hard to say definitely not, because, who knows what level of examination she had at that point.
Said that there was a potential. Was it with Marcy or somebody else in the family?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I just meant, I during my research, I did find that connection, that, epilepsy and, tumor, brain surgery, all those kinds of things, as you're alluding to, appear to be sometimes, triggers for that. But nothing that we can find with Marcy, no.
All right. So this activity is amping up. I mean, it starts off little, and as she gets older, you said again, how old was she when it finally exploded?
She was 10 years old.
Okay, about
11.
10.
Yeah.
All right. And that's right in the wheelhouse. We've heard other guests that's kind of right in the wheelhouse of when this thing explodes. Now, all this is going on. I mean, it sends them out on the porch. They're screaming for help. An off-duty police officer, their neighbor, comes over to investigate this. Now, does he witness anything himself, aside from them being ecstatic and freaking out about this? Does he witness anything that he was able to visually or, maybe even in an audio form, hear anything that was going on in this house?
Yeah, he told them to stay on the porch, and he went, of course, he thought they were being robbed or so. He didn't know what to expect. So when he went in, he told them to stay on the porch. He went in the house, realized it was a mess, and the TV moved, and puzzled, he went over to it and put it back and then turned around and moved again. And then he saw the refrigerator had moved across the floor, and then he started hearing the recliners. That were there. They had three recliners in a tiny little house, but the tiny little 738 square foot bungalow, so tiny thing. But there was three recliners they had in the living room, and they were opening and closing by themselves. So he saw all this, and the family is still on the porch, and he didn't, know what to do. Obviously, so he called for backup, and more officers showed up.
Now, is he thinking maybe there is an intruder or somebody, there was a fight or something that took place, seeing all this stuff down? Does he, I mean, is he even in the realm of thinking something paranormal or supernatural has gone on?
You know, he soon, of course, figured out that it was, and he does say that in, you know, publicly, that when he saw this, then, you know, his mind said, oh, my God, this is paranormal. Not that using those words, of course. I don't even know if they used the word paranormal back then,
right.
You know, supernatural. And, but at first, most of the police officers and firemen, you know, when they first walked into the house, they normally, I know, like Officer Tomek, when he was called for backup and came to the house, and he thought that they were robbed, you know, that there was a break-in and things were damaged and
sure.
They didn't know what else to think, you know, And that's what Holsworth saw, too. He went in there and figured and wondered if there was somebody in the house. And then, of course, all this stuff happened, and he realized he was dealing with something different altogether.
Once they realize this, how, as law enforcement officials looking for logical answers, looking for something that they can put cuffs on and drag out, how do they start to respond? Are they acting differently among each other than they are with the family? Are they letting on to the family that they are aware that this might be of supernatural, you know, based in the supernatural sense, or are they still trying to remain calm and keep the family, you know, based in reality?
I wouldn't say that they... you know, most of them kept their composure, but they really didn't try to hide it. Depending on the officer, there may have been a difference in theory. You know, one officer said, oh, yeah, I didn't know if it was termites or what. You know, I mean, they were dragging it. Some of them were dragging at straws, and others clearly said, well, this is just way, you know, this is something supernatural. But they didn't tell the family, oh, this is nothing supernatural. I mean, there was so much activity going on that it would have been just stupid to even try to, you know, pretend. Because three police officers were even talking to Marcy when the chair floated up and did a 360, throwing her out of it. So, I mean, you know, things like that are happening. You can't really do anything. But, of course, yes, try to keep the family calm. But I was impressed that most of the witnesses, not just police officers, you know, they didn't, and of course, this probably isn't too unusual for the reality, but, you know, obviously much different than Hollywood. Usually, instead of running away, they would run towards the objects or try to, you know, they're dealing with something they just can't quite comprehend, and they want to go over to it. And that's what the police did time and time again. And they were very interesting, that the detail. And one great example is there was a TV that moved, and a police officer saw it, and he went over to it. And in the interview with Boyce Beatty, the investigator, he said, I knew it wasn't a trick because there was dust on top of the bureau, and the TV moved in a precise way, and the only marks underneath were the rungs from the TV. If it had been hooked to a wire and you know, and fake and dragged, it would have dragged the dust across the top of the bureau. So, I mean, that's the kind of level of detail that these guys approached this with. So it was really fascinating to see that they really were, every time an event happened, they, you know, they were trying to get rid of the obvious and go eliminate
right. We have about a minute left in this segment. Tell me real quickly, I mean, as the police are investigating, are there any of the cops that are thinking, you know, this is not a thing I want to deal with. This is not the kind of crime I'm signed up to check out. Were there any cops that wanted out of that case or dealing with it?
Yes, there's one police officer that backed out of the house without even turning his back. He backed out of the house and went into his police car and locked the doors and waited for his partner. He was hit with a cross off the wall, and he just got up and said, that's it, I'm out. And he backed up. I shouldn't laugh because it is scary stuff. But
well, yeah, in hindsight, it's funny, though. You consider the cops in there to protect us. A cross hits him, and he's like, all right, that's enough. I'll talk to you guys later. I'll be in the car. Let's take our break. We have to go to the break here, Bill. Top of the hour. We've got some stuff to take care of. When we come back, we'll continue talking about the world's most haunted house with our guest, William Hall, right here on Coast to Coast AM.